try and get through it. So, all right, we'll get the show on the road. As I said, a lot of interest in today's call, and today's guest, Craig Hickson, is on here by farmer demand, effectively. Earlier this month, Craig attended the Beef and Lamb New Zealand Farmer Council AGM in Auckland after the Red Meat Sector Conference, and made a presentation there on his view of some of the issues in the red meat sector industry and some of the just the practicalities and the day-to-day of running a red meat business effectively, which was really well received. And a lot of farmers we spoke to afterwards said it would be great to have that message to others. It's not a progressive meats message. It's a message just about red meat processing and marketing and retailing generally. So we've called that A View from Inside the Meat Industry and Who Can Affect Change and How. And we'll talk a bit more about that later, I think, when Mike comes on as well. But, Craig, thank you very much for joining us and coming on the call. And I think you're going to start with a bit of an explanation or a bit of a cover some of the key points from that presentation you gave us in Auckland.
Good morning, Aaron. And, yes, I'm happy to do that in a relatively brief manner. My entire working life has been in the meat industry, and I consider myself to be a student of it and will remain so, I'm sure, until I actually finished my career in that area. It's an industry that I have thoroughly enjoyed in spite of all of the vagaries that apply, but that's one of the things that makes it very interesting. And in that time I've been involved, it's been characterised by various cycles of discontent right from when I was a student in the 1970s through to the current, and those cycles of discontent contentments generally, I believe, only recognised after the fact, and that's relative to our current position, so it's a relative consideration. And these cycles primarily are of discontent follow when there's been relatively high prices by relatively low prices, and that's been the current situation. And why do the prices vary so much? And indeed, when I've asked farmers over the years as to what they'd really like from their industry, I can normally, it comes back to summarising these words, a desire for predictable, stable, consistent prices. And there's an implication, of course, that the prices, although they don't state it implicitly, that the prices are enough. And of course, for what each person enough is different. And when I first asked this question, which comes back to late 1980s, enough was $25 a lamb, and the next year it was 31, and then it was 45, and so on. But of course, each farm is different as to what's enough. The prerequisite to having stable prices, though, to be able to deliver that, is that you have to be able to match supply and demand. So that's a basic law of economics. And that's a difficult thing to do at all times. And I'd like to just cover off some of the reasons that are inherent to the industry and are actually inherent to our comparative advantage. So they actually come with the territory and the business that we're in. And running through those, I've identified eight fundamental factors in my mind. I don't pretend that they're necessarily the only, and some are other factors are subsets that follow through because these all interact with one another. But they are, and are not in any particular order. As we know, we have a biological industry, so we've got this gestation period between the decision to increase or decrease production and it actually happening. And those decisions are taken actually in isolation from what's happening in the market by individual farmers with regard to production changes. And those effects are down the line. So we've got this lag between when the decision to increase happens and when it arrives. And that lag makes it difficult to match supply to demand in that respect. Second point is compete to buy and sell. So this is nearly, not quite unique characteristic, but it's certainly an unusual one in that most industries and businesses and the ones that I know, you compete to sell in every case, but you don't. It's rare to compete to supply. Now, what this means is the meat companies are in the middle and they've actually got a joint focus and this divergence of focus between competing to sell means they have less in each area. And because we tend to live where we have the supply, then it's perhaps understandable that because that's more in your face, you get more of a focus on the buying side than on the selling side. And then every company's individual circumstance is different on any given day, and so their actions and the prices that are offered to farmers for purchase can be affected by a number of things other than the actual market price. So this clouds and confuses the signal and is not helpful, you know, in providing confidence in developing industry. So that to compete to buy and compete to sell is, of these factors I'm referring to, is the only structural one in amongst them. the next inherent with our population and the size of our industry is distance in the market. We have to export, and we've got some distance. We've got at least 4, if not 5 weeks generally in the pipeline with product on the water. If there's a change in demand on the other side of the world, particularly in Europe in this instance, there's a little less time to North America and Asia, then by the time we get the signal back from the people to say, well, demand's reduced or demand's increased, it's a 5 or 6 week lag time before we can react to try and balance that up. So hence, that's a destabilizing factor just through the lag of the distance and influence on the price. And then on the sales side, demand changes, a little bit like supply. It can change with the weather and fashion. So if it's hot weather, barbecue cuts sell. If it's cold weather, it's more roasting cuts and such like around holidays, etc. So those demand changes occur, and they're a long way away, and there's a lag in us actually understanding what the actual impact is. While we can estimate it, and our customers do that, promotions and specials as well, they never know for sure exactly what the quantity's in. So this adds, again, another variable to the balance between demand and supply. Very important factor is, I call it the disassembly process. In our case, farmers deliver something pretty well perfect and whole in the form of a carcass, ends up in the carcass in the plant, and because the best market for all of the cuts of the carcass on net returns doesn't reside in one particular place, these cuts are cut. So in the time I've been involved in the industry, we've gone from pretty near all carcass business now to all cut business, and the reason it's transferred to cut business over that 30 to 40 years is because we have generally better prices for the racks in North America and now a little bit in Russia, and the loins and the tenderloins, etc., in central parts of Europe, for the shoulder meat in Japan, for the legs in the UK supermarkets, and for the breasts and flaps, etc., and bones and fat and trim into China. So that disassembly process is an inherent part of maximising the value to the carcass. And the degree of difficulty there is that you've got to have, when a carcass comes in complete, you have to have customers and orders on hand exactly to match every one of those pieces in the same proportion at the same time. And that's the simple job of a marketing manager, extremely challenging, and the reality is that they always get it wrong. They can actually only hope to be always correcting themselves, working back towards the equilibrium, because they're going to have too much or too little of a given part of the carcass at any single point in time as a consequence of that fundamental driver to maximising value. And because of our distance to market, again, our population, we're export-orientated, and that brings us into at least three major currencies, if not more, but it's the US dollar, the pound, and the euro, the three major currencies, and their relative values and their fluctuation changes. So foreign exchange, New Zealand dollar moves for reasons other than the trade balance, and that throws, of course, variations which you'll be very familiar with. Then consider it's a perishable product. So this is both a good thing and a bad thing. It's a good thing in that it forces a discipline to turn the product over and keep inventories low, which is good. But when it comes to balancing the carcass and you get small market parcels and pieces that are left over here and there, then they have to be moved. They're going to be approaching the end of their life if they're chilled, a little longer if they're frozen, but still you don't like to go beyond 12 months, and you certainly there's much resistance to go beyond 2 years at the end of the shelf life, whether it be chilled product or frozen. It needs to be sold, and so these parcels can end up into the marketplace, and that again causes price variation. And the last point that I make in this area here is the biggest one of all in terms of our supply capability, and it's inherent in our comparative advantage is our weather. So we grow grass relatively well, generally have water, although you'd wonder in the last year, and we have these both seasonal patterns to caused by grass growing in the spring, and we have events like droughts and snowstorms, etc., which cause issues. So these add variability to the supply equation, reduce the ability to predict it with confidence, and as a consequence that has an impact on how well we can match supply and demand. So when you add up all of those factors, and I've outlined eight there, you can say it's no wonder that there's considerable variation in the prices that are received and returned at the farm gate. And in many cases, the best we can do is to look to mitigate those variations. But my fundamental view is that the extent to which we can expect predictable, stable pricing will be a mirror image of the extent to which we can provide predictable, stable supply. And remembering our comparative advantage, effectively our cost advantage, is in pastoral farming, farming animals outdoors, and it's a biological system. So what we have is inherent in our comparative advantage is this disadvantage on the other side. So we need to take the advantage on one side and try and mitigate the effects on the other. And finally, in terms of my preamble, a lot of talk currently, and there has been many times in the past, and I've been involved in such discussions and more than one occasion with regard to industry reform, improvement, rationalisation, etc. under that guise. And one of the two important things, I think, to remember as farmers and suppliers is that there exists already two absolute prerogatives for farmers to influence change and to make change. And they are summarised in the first one is supply choices. And this happens now, and every farmer exercises that choice every year a number of times about who they choose to do their business with and supply their stock to. So a simple way of effecting change is to choose the company that best is aligned with your thoughts as to how the industry should operate and support them through their supply. And if enough farmers vote in the one direction collectively, then the industry will change absolutely, because it must, because supply, in fact, it's an underpinning fundamental requirement for the viability of any company along on the demand side. And the second one is with regard to the owner's prerogative. So if you're an owner of a business, then it's your prerogative in terms of being a shareholder to see that that business is running to serve the needs of its owners. And it's only the owner's prerogative to do this, and there's opportunities to take shareholding in New Zealand meat companies or indeed to invest and start up your own one. And so it's not the prerogative of someone who isn't an owner to actually tell someone who is an owner what they should do. And I've used the analogy in the past as, how would you feel if you had, for example, a farm that was considered to be less than a full economic unit, but you're happily farming it, and someone from outside comes along and says, I think you should sell your farm to the guy next door because you've both got suboptimal units, and if you put the two together, then one of you can have one good one, and we think he's a better farmer than you, so he should have it. And I'm sure you'd tell him to go and stick it in a dark place. As you have your own decisions or choices which you exercise as to how you farm your property, and it's not for someone else to tell you how to do that. And the same thing applies to the ownership of meat plants. But if you're unhappy with the way things are, then I believe you abdicate any right to criticise unless you're prepared to get off your chuff and do something about it yourself. And you've got two ways in which you can do it at least, and that's through your supply choices. And collectively, farmer voting with their feet would be very powerful in this respect, and you have an ownership choice as well to make to have an involvement there. So Aaron, that's really sums up my presentation that I gave at the conference.
It does. Excellent. Thanks, Craig. And look, we had you gave us a copy of your slides, and I'll have a yarn to you about afterwards about making those available as sort of your written summary. But you've answered a couple of the questions. I think the others sort of expand on what you've said. And I guess the first one might be the easiest one. It's certainly the simplest one. If you had a magic wand and you could wave it, what would be the change you'd make? And would it be getting completely committed supply, or from what you had just said, what would be your first wish, I guess, if you had all the power?
So, well, I think there are two broad routes, as I understand it. One, you seek differentiation in your product so you don't compete on price. And then having different sellers with differentiated products is actually an advantage, because you can bring to bear individual motivation and entrepreneurial flair to do that. But where the products can't be differentiated or aren't differentiated, whether, let's say, by definition, commodities, then there's definitely value in collaboration. So those are the two broad sectors. As far as committed supply goes, there are companies already have established commitment programs and have had committed supply for a long period of time. Myself at Progressive, we've been operating a commitment program since 1987, so it's not a new concept. And we know from the red meat sector strategy studies that somewhere in the order of 80%, it might be 75 to 80% of farmers are already loyal to one company and do supply all of their single species to one place. So we're primarily talking about a relatively small proportion in terms of the gap, And we're also primarily, I believe, talking about the winter, is that the commitment to supply and the loyalty is certainly clearly there with the breed of finishers and the family-type farmers right through the peak season. And in the winter, when you get more into the specialist finishers and the traders, that's when I think more of the trading-type approach or mentality takes place, and also because supply is short in the winter, and therefore I guess companies are more amenable to having their arm twisted or indeed with regard to making up their supply at that time of year. I think in terms of the compete to buy and sell, that it would be a step forward and for us all to be in a commitment program, and the decision to as to which company that you choose to supply for the year was made on an annual basis. But I do believe it's important that that choice still remains with regard to maintaining the competitive spur, and, which is a important motivating factor in the improvement process and keeping people striving to improve on what they're doing to be better and lift their levels of efficiency.
Great. Actually, and that leads nicely into a couple of other questions. And but one, I'm not... It's up to you how much or how little you say about this one, but the red meat sector strategy you mentioned, and one of the questions that came in was, what do you think of it? I mean, it's a couple of years old now, and obviously there's a bit of agitation in the industry at the moment, and the red meat sector strategy was developed last time to hopefully address some of that. Are you any thoughts you'd be prepared to share?
Certainly, well, a number of thoughts, really.
Yep.
I could get them in a particular order. Firstly, we should. Well, I think it's worth reminding ourselves that that strategy document, when it was put together, was done so by intelligent people who consulted widely throughout the industry and was surprised at the general consensus of views as individuals when they gave around areas of, you know, let's call them challenges, problem areas, and opportunity, and so a high degree of consensus about the things needing to be addressed. So the aligned procurement aspect of it comes in this compete to buy and sell aspect, or I feel more the compete to buy characteristic. The opportunity for productivity improvements on farm, and they always exist in all sectors of the business. There's always the opportunity to be better than what we are, so that's pretty standard. And collaboration in the market is referring about the competing to buy, competing to sell aspect of commodity type products. Now, we have examples of initiatives and developments in all three of those areas, both existing and developing. And if there's a frustration with the factory, is that people have said many times, and it's really a well-worn-out cliche, there's no silver bullet in a single aspect. It's a combination of the actions. So I'd like to refer back to frustration of suppliers and say, well, why aren't you other bastards doing something about it? Is that it's within our power as farmer suppliers to do something about it ourselves, and we have to accept that responsibility as to how many choices we make in transactions and selling the product from our farm during the course of the year, is that we are exercising choices there that are actually reflecting and influencing the future structure of the industry and the behaviours. So each time if a farmer believes we want to have an improvement, we've got to think about, if I'm not prepared to commit for a period of time to an individual company, then I'm actually saying implicitly that I'm supporting a system that has decisions taken on a short-term basis, which adds to the variability, etc. So we're all party. It takes two to tango, and every time there's a transaction, actually forms part of the fabric and framework of the industry. So we can't stand aside and say someone else should actually fix it. The power to fix it actually rests in our hands right now as individuals. And if enough of us behave in the same way. So we end up using this excuse to say, well, if I don't do it, somebody else will. So, of course, that means it never happens. So, you know, the responsibility comes back to us each, in my view, individually, to look to behave ourselves in the manner to which we'd look to see the industry behave. And if we all do that, then the industry will change for sure.
Excellent. Aaron, thanks, Craig.
Aaron, it's just Mike here. Can I just add something in there? Because I've had a couple of questions about this over the last couple of days as well. And in particular, just to reinforce the point, look, I've had a few farmers say the millions we spent on the red meat sector strategy. The red meat sector strategy was a document compiled by Deloitte on behalf of the meat industry and ourselves and the government. The cost to farmers for that document was $125,000 through Beef and Lamb New Zealand. the total cost of it. So, you know, this is a document that's done quite cost effectively. But the second, the main point I really want to make is that that I actually think there's been real success out of that document, and the fact that, as Craig's referred to, there was consensus among a wide number of views that were canvassed. And in fact, there's still no disagreement. In fact, every time I see debate around the industry, they're still referring to the three themes identified in the document as being the ones that need to be addressed. Basically, the adoption of best practice right across the sector, more efficient and aligned procurement, and then greater collaboration in market. And so Craig's talk this morning has focused on a number of those areas and how we can affect that change. So I actually think the document has become ingrained in the discussions around the industry, which is great, and we just want to see faster progress towards getting results out of those.
And Mike, you might care to add how that's helped with the PGP process too, in collaboration, industry players.
That's right, Craig. And in fact, you'll all be aware that it's now called the Red Meat Profit Partnership, which is a partnership between yourselves as farmers through Beef and Lamb New Zealand and 10 other companies from the meat industry and the banking sector and some professional firms. And so the project to really accelerate the best practice component of the strategy, the best practice theme, the work in, to try and accelerate that is actually going to happen through the Primary Growth Partnership application that is recently got approval and is just awaiting signing. So this is a truly collaborative approach across the farm gate through the professional services and banking sector firms to try and assist farmers behind the farm gate to achieve that key aim in the red meat sector strategy. It's simply that project, Aaron, would not have happened without a sector strategy document behind it.
All right. Well, here's a question that actually just came in, Mike, seeing as you're on the line, and Craig might want to comment as well about the red meat sector PGP. Craig talked about the choices behind the farm gate. You know, business ownership are the responsibility of the owner. It wouldn't be for a third party to come in and say you should sell to your neighbour and that'll be better for the industry. Is that an analogy with what Beef and Lamb are trying to do with the PGP, that we're trying to come behind the farm gate and tell farmers what to do?
Oh, no, not at all, Aaron. And in fact, the overwhelming feedback we've had from farmers is that farmers want to do better. I have not really, well, I haven't yet heard a farmer tell me that they don't want to make more money. And so from that point of view, that what this is about is their own organisation providing some tools and information and services alongside the industry to try and help them help themselves. We're not forcing anyone to go and do anything. Remember, at the end of the day, this comes down to individual choice, but there are a huge amount of farmers out there that are firstly saying, look, I really need to know how I'm performing relative to others, and then identify the areas in which I need to improve, and I need to do that much more efficiently. And that's exactly what the red meat sector strategy is going to do, is try and provide those services so farmers can help themselves.
All right.
If they choose
Thanks,
to.
Thanks, Mike. I'll that just sort of came in and aligned with what you were talking about. I'll just, another question for Craig, and you talked about one of your eight key characteristics was weather, which is and our climate and seasonal pattern, which is both a strength and a weakness, I guess. The question that came into one of our callers is that in where a lot of our country is now, hill country, harder hill country, manipulating supply and out-of-season supply, et cetera, is very difficult, may not be cost-effective, might not be really possible. What are an option for something like what Fonterra is doing, where we supply New Zealand lamb for 6 months of the year and we have an arrangement or take ownership of, say, Welsh lamb and supply these for the remaining six? So we've got year-round supply but not trying to do it through production changes back here in New Zealand.
Well, absolutely, and if we think back, that was actually the way it was the genesis of our industry in 1882 and the basis of supplying product from the southern hemisphere to complement, in that case, when it all went by carcass to England and did up until they entered the EU, which is in relative recent history in comparison. We need to remember with regard to the suggestion around Wales, et cetera, that's about 50%, or a bit less now, actually, maybe 45% in the UK and Europe of the lamb that's exported out of our country. And so being able to have complementary supply into a marketplace is dependent upon there being a local or alternate supply available to fill the gap. So what's being suggested here is happening, and there has been New Zealand Meat Company representation in Europe for many years, and still offices maintained there. There are customers like Waitrose, for example, that have specifically British lamb during the summer and New Zealand, during their peak, and New Zealand lamb during the alternate. When you get into North America, though, and you're wanting to supply someone there, then the lamb population is relatively low, and so they don't have the ability, and it's also a substantially different characteristic. So you can't achieve easily a continuity of supply using the seasonality of Northern Hemisphere, Southern Hemisphere into your customers there. And from a straight marketing viewpoint too, there's a mitigating factor to be considered with regard to having your brand in front of the people and not looking to give the alternate brand or the alternate company an opportunity to be knocking on that customer and putting yourself more into their competition. You try and avoid that where you can. On this particular aspect, I was heartened recently in a trip coming out of the States, and someone that's been in the business for some time and has been, I'd say, on the alternative lifestyle side a little, but they'd recently made the transition from buying local to buying best in season, and I thought that was a really positive thing, and as it was California, where they tend to lead some of the thought processing fashion trends in the world, that this means we can never be local in terms of supplying, but we certainly can be best in season. And so I see a resurgence in this area of best in season supply, where we have complementary supplies from different hemispheres.
Excellent. Okay.
Aaron, just yes, something Mike. On that, and of course the point that Craig talked about earlier, the disassembly process will mean also that that the complementary supply may work for some cuts, but it might not work for others. And some of the most lucrative markets for some cuts might be 52-week supply. I think it's fair to say, Craig?
Yes, that's fair. Yes. So it's not, that's a very important point. It was worth reinforcing, is that, of course, as a farmer, we see a whole animal leave the farm gate, but by the time it leaves the meat plant, it's divided up in many ways to many different destinations, and it therefore comes in terms of the balance of each individual piece of the carcass, not balancing of whole carcasses.
Great. So last question for you, Craig, although you're welcome to stay on the line when we shift the mic, and you may want to add some comment as he has added a bit of comment to some of your answers. The question came in from the caller that he believes the Chinese are pushing to receive whole carcasses, and this goes back to what you talked about, the change in the industry. So is that the case? And if it is, are we at risk of what's happened to some of our other manufacturing or similar industries like clothing, where a lot of those value-added opportunities have gone offshore because of lower labour and operational costs?
There's no doubt that China is, all the appearances of being a voracious market, and the development of our business and the proportion of our trade that's gone there has risen dramatically, even in the last year. But there's two parts to this equation, one's cost and one's revenue. And one of the characteristics of the Chinese, and I'm generalising here, is that they tend to value the cuts from a carcass at much the same value. So there's not a large differentiation as a generality between breast and flaps as a product and racks, for example. So what that's actually been hugely to our benefit as an industry, because it's meant we've been able to sell the cuts generally at lower values, the flaps and the breasts and the trim, at close to the average carcass price. But we still have better prices elsewhere in the world for the racks and the loins and the tenderloins, and up until recently also for legs and shoulders, but now some of those items are going into China as well. We receive inquiries from China pretty well on a daily basis, and I'm sure most other meat companies may even receive more inquiries on that basis. And yes, there has been times more recently where there's been inquiry for whole carcasses or carcasses cut in a simple fashion. So I believe I'm not too concerned about that nature. One wants to cover off the risk by not having all your eggs in one basket. But the two key things that is very clear that we do want to hold on to when it comes to processing in particular is, or consideration of it, is that we want the supplier relationship, which is course, to one here in New Zealand, and we want the customer relationship. And if I use an analogy of Icebreaker, for example, they've got the supplier relationship with their merino wool suppliers, and they've got the brand and the customer relationship, and they just get it manufactured in the most efficient and least cost manner to enable them to service the needs of their customers. So in this case, with regard to China, if some of the processing was to occur there for the future, I wouldn't be concerned about that in principle, but what I would be wanting to make sure is that we had the relationship with the customers so that we were in control of the value chain in that respect.
Brilliant. All right, one quick and hopefully easy question, Craig, just to wrap up. Beef and lamb have said about early forecasts is a $98 national average lamb. Others in the industry have sort of said around $100 thereabouts. What's your pick, if you're willing to make it?
Yeah, no, I think that sounds like a pretty good guesstimate to me.
Good answer. Thanks, Craig. All right, look, Craig, if you can stay on the line, because there may be some things we might or might have some comments or from you later on, but I'll hand over now, going 8 o'clock, over to Mike Peterson, our chairman. And, Mike, you may want to reflect on some of what Craig said and maybe had a few questions about where things are at in the moment. We hear about talks going on and discussions and Beef and Lamb New Zealand's role and all of that, and Craig's touched on some of that. So just whether you might want to give us some of your thoughts on those topics.
Yeah, certainly, Aaron. Look, I think Craig has always sums up, you know, the issues in the industry very, very well. And, you know, I think the important point to take away from it is that, you know, if we're looking for stable and consistent or predictable and stable returns, then first of all, you've got to address the, you know, the supply issue. And that's the overriding message, I think, that that needs to come out of it. The second one, though, that and this relates to the structural questions around, you know, whose prerogative is it to change the structure of the industry or to affect change? And as he talked about, two absolute prerogatives and the ability to influence change is through farmers as individuals, firstly with who you supply, and secondly as owners and shareholders of companies. And I think it's a really important point, you know, that we all need to consider. There are a lot of people asking other people to try and address the industry's challenges without looking, firstly, you know, at how we're acting ourselves within, back on farm. So, Aaron, look, there have been a couple of questions coming. One of them here, I notice, given the state of the sheep and beef industry and its rapidly declining scale, you know, does Beef and Lamb view this as market failure in context of industry structure? And I guess the reality for our sector is that land use change has happened. It's probably our biggest challenge, and in my view will continue to happen, particularly on the good land down in irrigated land down in South Island and down in Southland where they don't need to water. And so it's a fact of life, and land use will always move to its most efficient use over time. And we just need to try and get the profitability of our sector up to try and stop that land change from happening. There's one thing that could stop the land use change happening, and that's a regulatory environment, particularly around water and nutrients. I think that could put a bit of a halt, but we're still really working our way through that to see where it all lands. So the second part of that question was if we see it being a failure of industry structure. I don't see it as a failure of industry structure. And in fact, I would still argue, and the red meat sector strategy was quite clear in that the structure was not the overriding issue, but the behaviour of the participants was the issue that needed to be addressed. And so so I think that that's really where we need to look, and Craig summed that up pretty well today.
Sorry, Mike, just a question that has come in on that, and Craig touched on it, you've just touched on it there about farmer choice and farmer behaviour, but how do farmers make that choice? Where do they get accurate information on the commercial companies? And Craig may have some thoughts on that as well, but how do farmers, Craig talked about an annual choice, and you've talked about it there again, how do farmers make that choice? What information do they use?
Well, I said openly that farmers need to go and effectively interview the people they're supplying their livestock to. You know, I'm still surprised that farmers will send $1 million of livestock to a company without interviewing them or the marketing managers and the procurement managers to try and understand whether they are philosophically right for their business. It's simple as that. And so I just demand interviews with every one of them before entering into a contract for $1 million of supply. And it's as simple as that. No one else can make that decision. The only people that can make that decision are the farmers themselves. Craig, do you have a view on that?
I'd reiterate that. To the best of my knowledge, all of the companies will offer, they have supplier meetings, they have shareholder meetings, and they have offices. And so much as you'd make choices whether you're buying or selling goods elsewhere where you're making that choice, I'd just talk to them. That would be the best. Talk to the people. You know, and generally in business, you like to do business with people that you get on with and have got an empathy with, and that's why the best way to do that is to go and meet them and listen to them and seek an explanation. Ask the questions, that's what I'd say, about the things that you want, and talk to more than one so you can get a comparison and some relativity, and then make your choice and exercise it.
Mike, you were sort of on, we had a couple of questions come in, and the next one in that list that you were working through was about Beef and Lamb New Zealand's role to support and or, you know, either directly with funding or indirectly, I guess, the likes of Meat Industry Excellence and what they're doing in their analysis. Do you want to talk about what has been done, what can be done, what will be done?
Yeah, certainly. Look, the Meat Industry Excellence group, you know, a group of very well-meaning farmers that are getting around the country and trying to effect change. And so we at Beef and Lamb New Zealand, on behalf of our farmers, have funded a portion of their costs, particularly their travel and meeting expenses that they've incurred to date. And we've also offered in any of the industry talks that are happening right now to provide some funding for further analysis on any proposal that might be tabled that's been agreed on to make sure it's in the best long-term interests of farmers. So look, we have made that offer. We made that offer back in, I think it was 2009, I think, when the 80% concept was floated by Owen Paul and the Alliance Group, and that offer remains open today. But I think the important thing is here, we need to see a proposal that is going to happen, that is going to get underway. We see limited value in just funding a whole lot more analysis around industry structure if we haven't got the buy-in from the participants themselves. So I think that's a really important point.
Aaron, if I may, I think to reinforce a point that's already made, but it's worth reinforcing, the Meat Industry Excellence Group is a group of concerned people who are concerned about the composition and would like to influence change for the better. I'm not necessarily sure about what the action of that particular for the better means. And they, like many other people before, have also had the same aspirations. But we've got to come back to their ability to influence is to actually try and convince other people that they should change the way they behave or the way that they do their business. And that actually means them as individuals and all other farmers as suppliers, and those two prerogatives that I referred to earlier. One is they've got to only people that can exercise the change is not the group themselves, it's actually suppliers and their choices, so they have to influence suppliers collectively to do that and others, and or the shareholders or owners of meat companies. So in their own entity, the Meat Industry Excellent Group, Mike Peterson, or Bruce Wills, or the Mayor, or the Prime Minister, or anyone else, the Nathan Guy, they don't have, as individuals, the prerogative to force the change. They don't have the prerogative to tell a farmer who he should supply, and neither do they have the prerogative to tell a shareholder or an owner of a business how their business should be run, other than within, you know, a regulatory framework which takes into account the other parties. So...
Great. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. No, excellent. Thanks, Craig. Mike, we're just coming down to the last sort of 4 or 5 minutes. I just wonder if there's anything you want to reflect on, add to what we've talked about today, or add that we haven't covered yet. And before we wrap it all up, I'll give you a couple of minutes. How's that?
Yeah, thanks, Aaron. And so let's just carry on from where Craig left off. So at the end of the day, the only people that can influence change are the owners of the assets, and particularly farmers as suppliers, they could certainly influence change in that way. And I think it's interesting to reflect that often we look at Beef and Lamb New Zealand, or people look to Beef and Lamb New Zealand to try and affect change. I never see the same in the dairy industry, funnily enough. So I don't see people look to Dairy New Zealand to change the structure of the industry. I don't look to people in the horticulture sector that have a far more fragmented industry than ours to see horticulture in New Zealand change the structure of the industry. So I think that I would just encourage everyone to get involved in the discussion and the debate. It's really important. But first and foremost, make sure that you're acting in the way that you can to affect change yourselves. So as individuals, as Craig said, if enough of us collectively acted, then we would certainly see change. And I think that's a real challenge that we've all got in front of us. Getting agreement on an outcome or an endpoint for change is going to be incredibly difficult. But look, I am still encouraged by the meat company talks that are happening, and I think it's really important that we let those come to a conclusion one way or another, so that we can then see whether we've got something to debate as far as the proposal is concerned or not. So until that happens, I think we're best to give them some time. But I think the important point in that too is that we haven't now got a lot of time, because next season's coming quickly, and so if there is going to be something tabled, then we need to get that on the table, particularly over the next couple of 2 or 3 weeks. All right. So look, Aaron, I'll just leave it to that, unless there are any other pressing questions, and hopefully it's been thought-provoking, and people can go away and, look, as always, come back to any of us with any other questions they want to follow up on.
Brilliant. No.